I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 21st of July. After 20 months of negotiations, on July 14th, Iran and the U.S., China, France, Russia, Germany, and the U.K. signed a deal that limits Iran's nuclear activity in exchange for the lifting of economic sanctions. This hour, we will talk about that nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Our first guest is Dr. Nancy Gallagher. She is interim director at the Center for International and Security Studies at Maryland and a senior research scholar at the School for Public Policy at the University of Maryland. And they have done a very interesting study on a survey of the citizen cabinets in Oklahoma, Maryland, and Virginia. We'll talk about that during the course of this hour, and you'll be fascinated by what they're doing in that regard. Before coming to Maryland, she was the executive director of the Clinton administration's Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty Task Force. She has been an arms control specialist in the State Department, and she is the author of a number of books, including The Politics of Verification. Coming up later in the hour, we will speak with a scientist who's the scientist in residence at the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies at the Institute of International Studies. He focuses, Dr. Frank Dalnaki-Veras, on the proliferation of fissile materials, nuclear spent fuel management, nuclear reactor safety, and also verification of nuclear disarmament. There's been a lot of controversy about this deal. Of course, now the president of the U.S. and the president of Iran have to deal with their legislatures to give approval to a deal. Our guest, I think, put it well when she said it's a deal that gives everyone what they need, but does not give anyone everything that they want. We'll be welcoming phone calls for our guests. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. We're also on email at talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We love to read your comments there. And we're on Twitter as well, at K Dunn Show. Dr. Nancy Gallagher, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, I'm happy to be here.
Let's talk about the length of this negotiation. This was a long time coming, wasn't it?
Well, it was a very long time, particularly since the United States has been working on this really since the early 2000s.
Mm-hmm. And you have called it, I love the way you described it, when you say it gives everyone what they need, but not necessarily what they want. Talk more about that. What do you mean?
Well, and that's the nature of arms control negotiations, is that you go into it with a maximalist position to see basically how much you can achieve. But in order to actually reach an agreement that all parties consider to be both mutually beneficial and equitable, and that they are willing to sign, ratify, and implement, you have to make compromises. So this deal involves compromises on a number of different levels, with the underlying objective of providing the world with reassurance that Iran's nuclear program was purely for peaceful purposes, while enabling Iran to re-engage politically and economically with the rest of the international community.
You have called it a diplomatic masterpiece writ large and small. That's a big statement.
I feel that way about it because I think that it managed to get both the big questions right, the big principles, and it also paid really close attention to the details and making sure that the details were spelled out in such a way that there's less probability of there being misunderstandings, confusions, disagreements in the future, and if they arise, as they almost always do, that there's a procedure in place that could be used to resolve them cooperatively if the parties want to do that.
How difficult will it be in this country for President Obama and in Iran with President Rouhani to convince their legislatures that they need to approve this deal?
Well, the American public overwhelmingly supports this approach, and that's what we found in a series of these citizen cabinet surveys that we've done. Congress is a different question, and Congress has been much more skeptical about whether or not any deal with Iran that didn't completely outlaw uranium enrichment was a deal worth having. The situation for President Rouhani is largely the same. Again, we found in public opinion polling work that we did with the University of Tehran that there is strong public support in Iran for a deal, but that strong support is in part dependent on the mistaken assumption that the deal involves lifting of all U.S. sanctions, when actually it only covers the sanctions put in place by the U.N., the EU, and some of the sanctions that the United States has imposed for nuclear-related reasons, but not sanctions it's imposed for reasons having to do with Iran's human rights record or its support for terrorism.
Mm-hmm. And there obviously is vocal opposition to this deal, mostly on the part of Republicans here in the United States. Why is it so vocal? And of course, in Israel, Netanyahu's been incredibly outspoken about this. Is it because of, which is understandable in some sense, what leadership in Iran has had to say about Israel, what it's had to say about the United States? It's hard to ignore those other issues, and they are important when looking at this issue, isn't it?
Well, I would say, you know, we're somewhat used to our own politicians saying things in very strong and colorful language. When political leaders in other countries do that for their own domestic political reasons, sometimes we don't know how to interpret it or we don't know how representative it is. Netanyahu certainly has been a very outspoken critic of the deal. Interestingly, a lot of the Israeli security establishment has a different attitude towards it.
Really?
Yeah, and basically feels like it's better to have an agreement in place with very tight restrictions and inspections on Iran that will prevent Iran from being able to make any progress, should they choose to do so, towards a nuclear weapon for at least 8 to 10 years. That basically will delay, you know, an Iranian nuclear weapon longer than any other option would, including military action. And that what matters more to Israel's security is its relationship with the United States. So they are very concerned that the stance that Netanyahu's taking on this is creating a rift between the two countries.
Mm-hmm. Are there any critics that you've heard, Dr. Gallagher, who have offered credible proposals for achieving a better outcome?
No. A number of the Republican presidential candidates have literally said that they could have done better quite easily, but they've not given any convincing evidence to suggest that that's true. And I think it's important to remember that, you know, the Bush administration started worrying about Iran's nuclear program in the mid-2000s, but its initial approach was a purely coercive approach, basically a combination of economic sanctions and military threats. And that did not bring Iran to the negotiating table. Instead, it basically led Iran to increase their enrichment. When President Obama took over, he increased engagement with Iran, but still kept in place the coercive sanctions and actually got the international community to agree on several more very tight rounds of sanctions, again, with the purpose of bringing Iran to the negotiating table. And while that was the dominant Obama administration's approach, the Iranians kept increasing both the numbers of centrifuges they were operating and the level to which they were enriching. It really wasn't until the U.S. signaled that it was serious about finding a mutually beneficial compromise agreement that the Iranians stopped increasing the enrichment that they were doing and started the serious negotiations.
And tell me about the extent of the sanctions and how they're affecting other countries as well. Other countries have put sanctions on Iran and would like to see them that end, I've read.
Yeah, I mean, there are multiple different levels of sanctions. Basically, they're U.S. unilateral sanctions, and we've had many of those in place, you know, all the way back into the revolution. Some were imposed in the 1990s, then additional ones have been imposed since then. The European Union has also imposed some sanctions, and then there are sanctions that were imposed by the U.N. Security Council that are binding on all countries of the world. The other thing that's in play here is that because the United States is, you know, basically the financial center of the world, it has the ability to impose what are called secondary sanctions, where it says to other countries, we don't want you to do X or Y or Z kind of business with Iran. And if you do that, we will not do business with you.
Mm.
So I would say that, you know, countries including Russia and China went along with the UN sanctions as long as they believed that that was the best alternative to war and that the purpose of the sanctions was not to stay in place indefinitely, but it was to bring Iran to the table to negotiate a deal along the lines of the one that we have achieved. They are very, very, not only the Russians and Chinese and the Indians, Japanese, a number of other countries, eager to have the UN sanctions lifted. They're very resentful of the U.S. secondary sanctions. So if Congress does not approve the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, and if it imagines that instead it's going to impose additional sanctions on Iran to somehow get it to agree to even stricter terms, that basically will involve convincing other countries who worked very, very hard to get this agreement in the first place that this was not a good agreement and that they should stand with us in doing more.
You have expressed some worries in your writing about this, that the administration, in wanting to get support from skeptical members of Congress here in the United States, will agree to things like increased arms sales to allies who are concerned about Iran, that they will hurt, that may hurt the chances of implementation of the deal. It may hurt expanding cooperation. Do you think that's the direction that the administration will go to get more support for the deal?
I think it is aware of that possibility, and it's trying to be very careful. And, you know, here you have to worry both about how Iran reacts to anything the United States decides to do, but also what it does to other aspects of the military balance and the security equation in the region. So for a number of years, for example, we've resisted selling very advanced military equipment to Saudi Arabia because we're concerned about the military balance between the Arab countries and Israel. If we were to decide to start selling things that we weren't willing to in the past to Saudi Arabia in order to basically provide them reassurance vis-a-vis Iran, that could raise some concerns for Israel. So this is it's a very complicated equation, and the temptation to basically buy support for this deal by making a side agreement has to be examined very carefully.
Tell me more about Rouhani. Is he much respected in his country? Is he a terrific negotiator?
I think he's both very popular right now. The approval ratings that we've seen and the polling that we've done are very strong. But I'd also say that one of the reasons why he was elected in the first place is that he's seen as somebody who's really good at bringing together different factions, whether they're domestic factions or different parties at a negotiating table, and finding a creative outcome that satisfies everybody. So, you know, sometimes when people say, is he a good negotiator, they mean sort of, does he manage to squeeze the very last drop out of the other side? But my definition of a good negotiator is somebody who's able to simultaneously get a deal that's good for everybody, and that will basically improve relations going forward, that people will want to implement, they'll want to uphold, and they'll want to keep working together.
We're going to welcome phone calls for you, and we'll do so in just a moment. Dr. Gallagher is also going to tell us, I think this is something that should be done for all significant pieces of legislation and for deals like the one that we're talking about today. It's a Voice of the People Citizen Cabinet Initiative, and they gathered a number of people from, 1,754 voters from Maryland, Virginia, and Oklahoma, and had them learn a great deal about what this deal was all about. And they presented two options for the U.S. to continue to pursue an agreement that would accept some enrichment by Iran, but with substantial limits that would preclude Iran from developing a nuclear weapon and intrusive inspections to ensure those limits are met, or for the U.S. to not accept any Iranian enrichment. Instead, the U.S. would continue trying to get other nations to impose new economic sanctions in an effort to persuade Iran to cease enrichment completely. So all of these people deliberated and they heard from experts, and we'll find out what their findings were. And isn't this a great thing to do in this democracy? You would hope that people in Congress are informed by the citizens as well. And here are very informed citizens who had deliberations, serious deliberations, and came up with what they thought. So here is our phone number. What do you think? Is this a good deal or is it fraught with difficulty? Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Dr. Nancy Gallagher is Interim Director at the Center for International and Security Studies at Maryland, Senior Research Scholar at the School for Public Policy at the University of Maryland. She has been an arms control specialist in the State Department and was executive director of the Clinton administration's Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty Task Force. We'll get your thoughts on this and also speak with a scientist about the verification process and where Iran is in the process of developing a nuclear weapon and how sites will be open to inspection, what the time frame is for inspecting those sites, what inspectors will be looking for. That's coming up a little later. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. What do you think of the historic nuclear deal with Iran? We welcome your phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number. And we start with Bill in Madison. Hi, Bill.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think it's a good deal, and I think it will be fraught with difficulties, as every relationship with a foreign country is, you know. But I'm curious about your guest's evaluation of the U.S. software attack on the Iranian centrifuges and how that played in this whole scheme. And also a follow-up, what does Iran do for energy besides nuclear? I mean, I guess that's the reason they need centrifuges. They've got plenty of sunshine. Are they doing anything with solar?
Well, to take your first question, the Stuxnet attack on Iranian centrifuges was something that I think the United States will live to regret, and I say that for two reasons. The first is that, you know, we are, as a country, extremely dependent on the Internet, on computers, and to, you know, set a precedent for using a cyber attack against another country with whom we were not at war, I think was a very bad precedent to set. Some people believe that it set the Iranian program back and delayed the rate at which they were able to basically accumulate enriched uranium. If you look at the timelines, though, I would say that the resumption of serious negotiations had a much clearer, more direct, more lasting effect on stopping the Iranian accumulation of enriched uranium than Stuxnet did.
Thank you, Bill, very much for the call. Dr. Gallagher, I wanted to make sure that we talked about this very, very interesting Voice of the People project, the Citizen Cabinet Initiative, that brought together people in various states to talk about negotiations with Iran. Tell me about how you've been doing this, how long you've been doing this, and how this one was fashioned. It's just a great, great thing. I think it should be done for all kinds of issues.
Well, this is actually part of a larger project that Steve Kull is spearheading that is doing this kind of thing for a number of different issues. And so he runs something called the Program for Public Consultation that's been working closely with CISM over the years. And we initially, about a year ago, developed together this decision-making simulation on Iran, which we've done twice now with nationwide samples, once last summer and then again in March, shortly before the terms of basically the agreement in principle was reached in Lausanne. And then it was repeated in depth in those three states a month or two ago. So what we have is sort of data from three different times in which we've run the simulation. And what I find so fascinating about it is that we put together a very short background briefing. It's about a page long, and we vet it with congressional staffers from both Democrats and Republicans to make sure that they think we're telling the public a balanced story and giving them the most important information on both sides of the issue. And then we present them with a choice that policymakers are going to have to make, you know, in this case, whether or not to support the negotiations or to stop that approach and try to use economic sanctions and other forms of pressure to get Iran to stop enriching. And then we ask people how they feel about those two options and on a 1 to 10 scale. And then we go through a series of pro and con arguments that have been drawn from the congressional record And again, you know, vetted with people on both sides of the issue so that they make sure that the strongest arguments that they have for their preferred option and the strongest arguments they have against the alternative option are captured accurately in the simulation, but also in terms that the American people can easily understand. We walk people through these arguments and ask them how convincing they find them. And at the end of that whole process, we ask them again, okay, how do you feel about these two options? And then we say, you know, okay, if you have to make a choice, which one do you choose, option A or option B? And basically what we found the three times that we've run this survey is that Americans listen carefully to the arguments on both sides of the issue. They, you know, generally find all of the arguments that we advance at least somewhat convincing, but that as they go through this process, as they get more information, as they hear arguments on both sides of the issue, their favorable attitudes toward a negotiated approach go up. The negative attitudes towards the alternative, towards ending negotiations and trying to impose more sanctions also go up. And people come down ultimately firmly on the side of a negotiated deal. In our nationwide surveys, it's been about 65%, both Republicans and Democrats, supporting a negotiated solution compared with in the mid-30s opposing it. And in the most recent round that we did in the three states, it was up in the mid-70s, including Oklahoma.
Those are really strong percentages, aren't they?
Well, they're very strong percentages, and they're very robust. I mean, the point of walking people through the pro and con arguments is to be able to say that this is what they think after they've heard both sides of the argument. So they're unlikely to dramatically change their view, no matter, you know, what the specific details are or what new argument you throw at them.
Bill, thank you very much for your call. Shane in La Crosse is next. Hi, Shane.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Great program today. This is very interesting. We'll learn more about this deal. My question for your guest today was, moving forward with the presidential election coming up here rather soon, how much of an impact does she think it's going to have on the election when I'm hearing multiple GOP candidates talk about how if they do get elected, they'll start to try to dismantle this deal right away?
You know, I would like to believe that that's something that they are saying while they're candidates, that they would reconsider if they were elected. I think it's, you know, something that's easy to say that you don't like whatever is on the table. It actually turns out to be really hard to come up with a better alternative and convince both the rest of the country and the rest of the world to go along with it. So I think that, you know, the fact that we see such strong bipartisan support among the American public for the negotiated agreement leads me to hope that we can keep it insulated from partisan politics as much as possible, but I recognize that that's extremely difficult to do during an election year.
Does it unravel all that's been done when you have people talk about, I'm going to tear this deal up, you know, immediately you have Republican presidential candidates saying that, who, and also talking about the possibility of a military option? What does that do to a deal that's already in place? Does it make people nervous?
I would say it does a number of things. You know, one is I think it causes other countries to question the United States' judgment and leadership. If we spent such a long time working so intensively with our allies and other leading countries trying to negotiate this deal, and then a large number of the presidential contenders basically dismiss it out of hand, that doesn't look like very serious presidential leadership to many other countries. In Iran, you know, I think it raises reinforces, I would say, some serious doubts about whether the United States will live up to its side of the agreement.
Right.
We hear a lot about concerns that Iran will cheat. The Iranians are equally worried that the United States won't provide the sanctions relief that it's promised, or that it will, in effect, say, you know, yes, we're going to lift, relax these nuclear-related sanctions, but then we're going to turn around and impose the exact same measures for some other objective. So, you know, part of what's been really, really interesting about these negotiations and part of why they have taken so long and part of why they've gone through the sort of, you know, the interim agreement and then implementing the interim agreement and both sides watching to see does the other side actually faithfully do what they say they're going to do, is that it's taken a long time for the two countries, I'm not going to say to trust each other, because they don't trust each other, but to have reasonable confidence that if the other side makes a commitment, that it will actually honor that commitment.
Mm-hmm. And does it strengthen? Would those poll numbers change, do you think, when we hear words that are really anti-Israel, death to the United States, from some Iranian leaders?
I don't think they actually will, because if you look at the way we worded the questions, we made it clear that, you know, there's some real good reasons to doubt what Iran's ambitions are, what their objectives in the region are, and nevertheless, even people who said basically there are such fundamental differences between the United States and Iran that conflict between the two is inevitable, they nevertheless supported a negotiated deal over ending the negotiations and trying to impose more sanctions by close to a 2-to-1 margin.
Hmm.
Because I think they concluded that if conflict is inevitable, they would much rather that Iran doesn't have nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is not, it's not people being naive. It's people being actually very hard-headed. The question that we asked, or the sort of pro-argument for the negotiated outcome that got the strongest support, was the argument that whether or not Iran actually complies with the terms of the accord, we're better off with it than without it. If they do comply, great. If they don't, we can catch it quickly and we can rally the international community to take much prompter, more decisive action than we can if we don't have the deal in place.
Well, and let's talk about how we're going to inspect and make sure they're living up to their end of this deal. We're going to add to our conversation. Dr. Gallagher will stay with us. We'll take more phone calls as well. So please, if you're on hold, just stay where you are. We'll be with your calls momentarily. But we wanted to find out about the science of all of this, what Iran has been doing to build a nuclear capability the past some years, how we determine, will determine whether or not they're cheating. Dr. Ferenc Dalnaki-Veras is our guest now, and so is Dr. Gallagher. He's a scientist in residence and adjunct professor at the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies at the Institute of International Studies in Monterey. He focuses on proliferation of fissile materials, nuclear spent fuel management, nuclear reactor safety, emergency preparedness, and verification of nuclear disarmament. Dr. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Dalnaki-Veras. Hi.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
Yeah, very nice to have you here. You know so many things that probably we don't fully understand, but we do understand how they, where they are now and what it would take for them to have a nuclear bomb and how we inspect all of this. Tell us, please, what you overall think of this deal. Is it a good thing for the world?
Oh, absolutely, I think it's a good thing. I think it's good for the United States, and I think it's good for the world. But you have to look at the finer points. I just want to talk about the risks, if that's all right.
Yes, of course.
You know, with the program. First of all, I want to say that in the 1970s, there was the Non-Proliferation Treaty, Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which basically set the world in two different camps. You have the non-nuclear weapon states and the nuclear weapon states. So these were the nuclear weapon states that had nuclear weapons at the time. But between these two camps, all states have obligations. So it's not like the non-nuclear weapon states don't have any obligations. They do, which is that they are allowed to develop nuclear power unhindered, and that's really the main point here, but they can't seek nuclear weapons. And that's kind of the hard part, because if you have a civilian nuclear power program, it overlaps with the military program, so the program to make nuclear weapons. And where it overlaps is something like enrichment, which you've heard a great deal about already.
Mm-hmm.
And just to give the listeners an analogy, if you have a power reactor fuel, so for power reactor fuel, you need to have enriched uranium, or most reactors, you have enriched uranium. You have 3-5% enrichment. Now, don't worry so much about what all that means. It just means that you have one kind of uranium compared to another kind of uranium.
Okay.
So 3-5%. And if you want to make a nuclear bomb, that's more like 90%. Now, generally you would think that, okay, 3 to 5%, it's pretty far away from 90%, right? But that's not quite the right way to think about this, because the enrichment process, and this is where the risk comes in, is not linear. So, for example, if you think of enriching to a bomb being like a marathon, which is 26 miles, then if you enrich from natural uranium, so the stuff that you get in the ground, and you enrich it further to 3 to 5%, which is what you would need for nuclear reactors, that's already 18 miles into the marathon.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really the concern here. And then it's easier just to enrich it further to get to weapons grade. That's why people are even worried with civilian program.
Right. So tell me, how will we know that they're not going beyond 3.5% or 5%? What is it, 5%?
It's 3 to 5%.
3 to 5.
That's generally what people think of. Well, there's safeguards, nuclear safeguards, which are declared facilities. Now, there's three other things that are important, is that there's three, basically, routes to produce the bomb. So the first case is where you say you have declared facilities, which are declared under that Iran declares under the IAEA,
mm-hmm.
that's the International Atomic Energy Agency, to inspect these facilities. And the worry there is that what they could do is they could just kick out the inspectors and immediately race to a bomb. Now, that's one big concern. It's called breakout, by the way. You probably heard that in the news a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But with the breakout deal, the deal that's just been struck, with breakout before the deal, it would have been 2 to 3 months to basically produce enough enriched uranium for a bomb. So that's before the deal. Now, after the deal, it's more like a year, and that's for 10 years. So that's, we basically shut down that route towards a bomb. So that's the one point. The other point is about the plutonium route. Now, I know you've heard a lot in the news about plutonium and the Iraq reactor or the IR-40 reactor.
Yes.
Remember, this is the heavy water reactor, which is at Iraq in Iran. That reactor is they declared it for producing medical isotopes. But in fact, it's exactly the type of reactor that you could use to make plutonium, which could be used for a bomb. And that's really the other route that's really important to shut down. And what the international community now in this deal, what they've said, is they're going to take that reactor and they're completely dismantling it and converting it into another type of reactor, which doesn't produce this weapons-grade plutonium. But the other thing to keep in mind is this is where all this civilian and military thing comes in, where the two intersect. Actually, all reactors produce plutonium. Even the reactor that you have now in Wisconsin produces plutonium. But that's not, but you know, it's inspected and so on, and that's not going to be used for a nuclear weapon, but it could be. So, that's kind of the complicated part. They intersect the two civilian and the military, they call them the fuel cycles, intersect. At many different points.
What's to say you couldn't have a whole series of clandestine facilities?
Yes, that's the other point, which is, what if they're cheating or something like that, right? And that's they call that sneak out, by the way, by James Acton from Carnegie, I think, coined that term. With sneak out, that's another possibility. And then the idea is you use clandestine facilities to, let's say, produce uranium or produce, have some secret reactor which is producing plutonium. You could have that option, but that's the fantastic thing about this treaty. It's going to make it way more difficult to do that because you have something called the Additional Protocol or the AP, and that's something that 126 countries have actually already signed. So there's something called the Comprehensive Safeguards Agreement, and this is an agreement that Iran does with the IEA, so that's the International Atomic Energy Agency, to go through the normal safeguards process. So all countries that are non-nuclear weapon states have to do something like the CSA, Comprehensive Safeguards Agreement. But the problem is that in the past, for example, North Korea and Iraq, they didn't declare certain facilities to the IEA, and they were actually secretly producing nuclear weapons. So
mm-hmm.
the world realized we need much stronger safeguards. And this is where this additional protocol came in. And so basically what it is, it has expanded rights beyond just regular, comprehensive safeguards agreements. So, for example, you could have access to all facilities that, you know, have to do with basically nuclear materials. And the other great thing is that the IAEA can do environmental sampling at locations that are not declared facilities. So even, you know, it would have to be negotiated, of course. This is, this 24-day agreement issue. But they could even go to military facilities, and there they could take environmental samples. And so they could see if there's, trace bits of uranium around and so on.
Mm-hmm.
The other amazing thing is that since the enrichment will only happen at Natanz, so that's one of the facilities, not at the other facilities, if you happen to see and find, uranium of the wrong kind or something that's out of order, uranium at another facility or in some other area, that's a violation. So by limiting it to one facility, you're kind of, you have that possibility that if you find it somewhere else, it's an immediate violation.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Gallagher, how much faith do you have in the inspections of the IAEA? Do they have a terrific record of spotting irregularities that are very problematic?
Yeah, no, I would say that they have a very good record. They're not perfect, but neither, obviously, is U.S. intelligence or Israeli intelligence or any of the other means that we might have to know what's going on inside a country. So we'll know a lot more about what's going on in Iran with the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action and without it. And it includes a number of measures that aren't part of the normal safeguards agreement or even the additional protocol. So, for example, if Iran were to try to establish a clandestine fuel cycle, it would have to be getting the natural uranium from someplace, either mining it without the international community realizing it or buying it from abroad. It would have to go through and have a whole separate secret facility set up to process that into the form that you could then feed it into centrifuges. It would have to get or make the centrifuge parts from someplace without anybody noticing. It would have to be able to operate an enrichment facility, which is incredibly energy intensive, without anybody noticing. And Iran has agreed to basically special provisions for the duration of this agreement to provide extremely high confidence that there's no way they could go through the entire sequence of things that they would need to do to operate a clandestine enrichment facility without the international community detecting it.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Dalnaki-Varis, what evidence do we have of where along the process Iran was, either in spoken word of how rapidly they wanted to be able to build a nuclear weapon or where they were in the process? Do we know that? Would they have had one in a couple years?
They never said that they wanted to build a nuclear weapon. That's never been what they said. There's evidence up to 2003 that they may have been wanting to have a nuclear weapon. Their side, from their point of view, is that they're purely interested from a peaceful, for power reactors and things like
yes.
that, not from a military point of view.
We welcome more phone calls for both our guests. They'll stay with us. We're talking about the Iran nuclear deal. Do you think that it is good? Will it have any other benefits? We'll move into that area of discussion other than keeping Iran from getting a nuclear weapon over, say, a 10-year period. Or will it have, are you hopeful that it will have other benefits, that there are other ways to work with Iran in this really, really difficult, dangerous part of the world? Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Dr. Ferenc Dalnaki-Varis is with us, scientist in residence, adjunct professor at Middlebury Institute of International Studies at Monterey, and he knows a great deal about ultra-low radioactivity background detectors, and he knows about the verification process and enriching uranium, all of that, the science of what we're discussing. And Dr. Nancy Gallagher is also with us, interim director at the Center for International and Security Studies at Maryland and a senior research scholar at the University of Maryland School of Public Policy. What do you think of the deal? What are your questions? What about the political response to this deal? What about how the president will talk about it with members of Congress who are not in favor of this, and there are many of them, and President Rouhani, how will he deal with opponents to the deal in Iran? And is it a pretty big thing? 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page. Leave your messages there. The Kathleen Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's an email that has come in asking, for instance, what about if Iran sends weapons to Hezbollah in support of Assad or to be used against Israel? Will that be implicitly okay now? And finally, are we not tilting our hand toward Iran and against Turkey? Dr. Gallagher.
This deal is about Iran's nuclear behavior. It's not about anything else that Iran does. So sending weapons to Assad is neither more nor less okay than it was without the deal. I don't see how this would be tilting toward Iran and away from Turkey. Turkey was actually an important player in trying to get serious negotiations going between the Obama administration and Iran. So I think this is something that they're actually going to see as being very good for them. Israel and Saudi Arabia are concerned that it may basically represent not a U.S. tilt to Iran's side, but a sort of shift in the regional balance where Iran is no longer so completely isolated. From a strict power politics perspective, they may think they're better off with Iran being weak and isolated. But I actually think if you look at the security problems that they're facing in the region, that they are better off if Iran is able to work constructively with them on some of those problems.
Let's go to Bob in Oconomowoc. Hi, Bob.
Hello. Thank you very much. I was just wondering if your guests could comment. What is the status of the Israeli nuclear weapons program? Where do they fit along the line of development or possession of nuclear weapons?
Let's go to Dr. Dalnaki Veras on that. Doctor?
Yes, so it's well known that Israel does have a nuclear weapon program, but they are not a signee of the NPT, so the same rules don't necessarily apply. That's the main point. But it's well known that Israel has a nuclear weapon.
The United States does not officially acknowledge it, but Israel is widely known to not only have a nuclear weapons program, but to have a significant stockpile.
Mm-hmm. And I know we don't exactly know what will happen, but considering the rhetoric that has come from Israel, what do you expect Israel's going to do about this deal? They're very unhappy about it. Dr. Gallagher?
I think that they will probably continue to do what they're doing, which is to express their dissatisfaction and to try to get as much reassurance from the United States as they can. I think, again, there's a big debate going on within Israel about whether they should continue to try to do whatever they can to persuade Congress not to support the deal, or if that's actually developing, turning Israel into a partisan political issue, building a rift between the United States and Israel, going against what a large percentage of American Jews want, and ultimately bad for their security interests.
Mm-hmm. You have said, Dr. Dalnaki Veras, that keep in mind, it's important for us to keep in mind that it is not reasonable for opponents to demand 100% certainty in verifying the agreement, and it is also not necessary. Why isn't it necessary?
Well, it isn't necessary because we have a lot of the machinery in place for the verification would be able to have reasonable certainty. I use the word reasonable certainty in the piece because it's not really possible to have 100% certainty. So if you think about, let's say, a science experiment or something like this, it's never possible to have, zero uncertainty. So exactly in the same way. But also you have to think about it from just a cost-benefit point of view. I mean, it's hugely expensive to have these safeguards programs, and you can't expect somebody to be there 24 hours a day. I mean, they have now, and that's an important thing about this deal, is that the IAEA has, Iran has agreed that they could have 24-hour access and have very sophisticated modern technology and things like that. So that's also a very important point. But it's just, it's not realistic to have, that much expectation, that you're going to catch everything. It's impossible to look under every rock, for example, right? It's just, and also there's other issues, which is something like, for example, a centrifuge plant. You'd be depending on things leaking out, so little bits of gas that would leak out. And from centrifuge plants itself, let's say, not that much leaks out. So you're depending on other things, like what's called national technical means, or basically intelligence services to be able to get information on clandestine facilities, or for example on open source networks of looking at things like satellite images and things like that. So it's kind of you can't expect 100% certainty, and no nuclear treaty actually has that. I mean, it's just impossible. And my worry is that what people in the Congress will demand is 100% certainty, and that's not something any treaty is able to have.
Mm-hmm. That's not something any policy option can provide. So if you look at the other alternatives for dealing with Iran's nuclear program, they're basically attempting to put in place even tighter economic sanctions so that either Iran is so poor that it simply can't afford to do things we don't want it to do, or the regime collapses. Or taking military action. Mm-hmm. And if you, assess the probability that either of those two courses of action would lead to a better outcome than this nuclear deal, I think they're very low.
And what happens in Iran when the economic sanctions are lifted? How does life change for people?
Well, that'll be an interesting question. I mean, we did some polling in Iran, and one of the things that we found that is that public support for the deal is very high, but it's based on the assumption both that sanctions relief is going to be much more extensive than it actually is, and that it's going to happen faster than it will under the terms of this agreement. Under the plan of action, basically, there are a number of steps that have to be taken and have to be certified by the IAEA before Iran gets any sanctions relief. Some people are concerned that suddenly Iran will have this huge influx of cash and they'll use it for all sorts of purposes that we don't like. My concern is actually very different, and that is that if it takes too long for the Iranians to feel real political and economic benefits from taking the negotiated route, that they may turn against the deal and against President Rouhani and other moderates.
Mm-hmm. And the deal, tell me what technically has to happen here in terms of getting support for it. What does the U.S. Congress have to do? What do the Iranians have to do to make this a reality?
Well, as I said, it's a complicated series of steps. So the agreement, has been finalized. It's been signed by the seven parties to the negotiation. The first thing that had to happen after that is a UN Security Council resolution endorsing the plan, which has happened. It's now gone into a period where it's being reviewed by both the Iranian parliament and Congress. The congressional review period is 60 days. The Iranian review period is somewhat shorter than that. Meanwhile, the IAEA is working with Iran on additional inspection provisions that would be put into place once the deal actually gets adopted. And sometime, probably mid-October-ish, Iran knows that, yes, Congress has approved this deal, the United States looks like it's going forward with this, then it will start carrying out a number of the additional, it's already done a lot of steps to constrain its nuclear program under the initial plan of action. And it has a number of further things that it has committed to doing. It will start doing those things once it knows that, yes, the United States is going to go forward with this deal. At the same time, the Obama administration will be doing what it needs to do to be in a position to suspend U.S. nuclear-related sanctions when the deal actually gets implemented, And the EU will be doing the same type of thing, and the IAEA will be working with Iran on trying to resolve questions about whether or not they did some weapons-related experiments.
And on that note, we thank you both very much. Such an informative hour. We're out of time. Thank you, Dr. Gallagher, and thank you, Dr. Dalnaki-Veras, for your time and expertise, I might add.
Well, thank you for having us.
Yeah, our pleasure. We have thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour, and news is coming up.